Hello, everybody, and welcome to not another episode of Quantum Kickflip. Wait, what's happening? I'm not your slug master, game blaster, Lane Anderson. No, it's me. It's Robin, the season one slug master, here on your feed on a day that should have a new episode of QK to tell you, whoops, surprise, we're doing a little bit of bonus content instead. This is just a little way for us to sort of get our schedule in order. We're gearing up for the final run of episodes in season two, our final run of the season, and we don't really want to take any breaks once that gets started because it's going to be very intense and action-packed, and we want to just keep the story moving forward. And so in order to do that better, we're taking a little bit of a break at the top here just to sort of buy ourselves some extra time to get everything recorded and edited and up for you in a timely manner. So with me today is one of my best and funniest friends in the whole world, and also my loving wife, Lane Anderson.
It's me. I'm still here. I wouldn't leave you alone, friends.
Yeah, we're both here together, the two GMs of QK thus far, here to do a little GM interview. Lena has so far interviewed all of the cast members on QK for our Patreon, which if you want to hear those, they're great. They give a ton of insight into the characters and little behind the scenes, like look behind the curtain at what the players were thinking when they came up with their characters and their goals and their dreams and their aspirations. They're fascinating to listen to and very, very fun. And you can find them all at patreon.com/quantumkickflip. You can support us for as little as $2 a month, and that gets you all the early access to the episodes, or $5 a month. You can get all that bonus content that I just talked about. Interviews are just one part. These glitches are, in my opinion, the big sales pitch.
Yes.
All of the outtakes from all of the episodes, which are sometimes like half an hour at a time.
Our intros outtakes take like 10 minutes now.
We get Ray off the rails like right quick.
Instantly,
in these episodes.
We do.
And they're some of my favorite moments from the show. And you don't get to hear any of those because they're all on the Patreon, unless you're one of our patrons, in which case, thank you so much. You might be listening to this on Patreon right now, in which case, we salute you. These colors don't run. Patreon. Anyways, Lena has interviewed the whole cast, so today we thought it'd be fun to flip it around, and I would ask Lena some questions about the process of GMing season two, to sort of look back on the season up to this point, and get us just really excited and raring to go for this finale that is coming down in just a few short weeks. So, first question, Lena, What drew you to Operablum as a setting for season two of Quantum Kickflip? What were you excited about, and what made you nervous about the setting of Operablum?
Oh, amazing question. And with it comes a deep, dark confession.
Uh-oh.
And that is, I stole it. I stole the idea to run the season in Operablum, and you act surprised, but I stole it from you.
This is what's wild about like this season and everything you've done it with it, that like it has become so wholly your creation and your vision for this world that I forget that I ever had any interest in doing Operablum as a season two. Like, it, in my mind, you came up with it, and then every time you remind me that it was a thing I pitched originally, I'm like, no, that doesn't sound right. Because yeah. I wouldn't have come up with any of this cool tower lore or anything.
Well, like, yeah, we had a bunch of different ideas for what we wanted to do for season two. A couple people were pitching a few different things, setting it in different dimensions, maybe even testing out new systems and stuff like that. And yeah, you had mentioned that, you know, Operablum would be a great setting to explore, like something more hard sci-fi. I say hard sci-fi, like Slug Blaster isn't the squishiest system ever for world building. And I think when we were first pitching these ideas and pitching who wanted to GM, my first impulse was, no, thank you. I don't want to GM. It's not for me. But then you were talking to me about, you know, a season in Operablum and what that might look like. And just these ideas started coming. And the first thing that sort of solidified for me was the philosophy of each of the towers, and it was entirely based on what we already knew from season one. I looked back at what settings we saw in each individual tower and, you know, the stuff that Weird Gravity went through. And from there, I came up with each tower having their own philosophy, Kindred being expansion, Lansden being restoration, and Web being adaptation. And that just seemed to make the world so clear already. It already gave such a strong foundation for all of us to build on. As for the what made me nervous about it, I mean, jumping into the GM role was definitely a nerve-wracking thing. I don't actually have a ton of experience with long-term GMing.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically the area where I tend to shy away, where I feel like I'm not as deeply invested in, is like the world building. You know, I have some friends who will draw the maps and figure out the political structures and what the economy of their yeah. world is like. And that couldn't interest me less. So to choose a very like sci-fi, cyberpunk dystopia vibe that we knew was going to be different from Null in every way was definitely pretty daunting. And I think the success of it came from all of us working together. Like that session zero where I came up with the questions for the towers and we all did a collective brainstorm on what each tower was like. Like I did a sixth of the work.
And if you want to hear that session zero, it's on our Patreon.
Yeah,
go
is.
Sign up for our Patreon. That's fantastic. I also love that you point out that like some of the philosophy was drawn from what we had seen of each tower in season one, because those things were completely arbitrary when yeah. I doled them out, like where the restaurant was and where the fight pits were. I wanted to say each tower name once,
yeah.
and I didn't put any thought into which one was in which. And even the tower names were just a dumb Blade Runner reference. It was not.
But even like Kindred Multiversal,
yeah.
right? It's like, okay, it's Kindred Multiversal Mega Tower, and it has Matt Static,
yeah.
the club that is known throughout every dimension for being super hip and super illegal. Okay, they are the ones that care about interdimensional connections and expansion and possibly moving to other dimensions.
I'm just saying you have done an amazing job taking a bunch of random bullshit I farted out and turning it into a cohesive world that has like internal logic and structure. It's incredible. What influences did you draw on for season two? And this can be like for the world of Operablum, what sort of influences inspired your world building, but also just for the story of season two in general, for sort of the arcs of the characters and the overall plot. Like what did you draw on when crafting this season?
Ooh, I think we watched the Blade Runners mm-hmm. in pretty short order, both the original and 2049.
Yeah.
Both fantastic, a yeah. great time. So there was definitely a fair bit of inspiration there. There were a couple of different touchstones that I think I pulled from to help fuel the aesthetic and philosophy of each towers.
Yeah.
Lansden has a very Star Wars, Firefly kind of vibe to it.
Mm-hmm.
I very much picture, you know, the very like dull gray kind of machinery, and like kind of a dusty feel. I don't think any of the towers are dusty,
yeah.
but that's still sort of like the vibe in my head.
Yeah.
I think Webb has a lot of like Matrix influence.
Yeah. A little Star Trek I get from Webb as well,
oh,
like
yeah.
a lot more like clinical in uniform than some of the other towers.
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of the very clean, science-y,
yeah.
Everything is chrome and slime and like smooth
yeah.
with Webb as well. I don't picture a lot of like hard corners, like the doors are flush with the wall kind of thing.
Yeah.
Kindred, I think, has a lot of Fifth Element.
Oh, yeah.
In there. And also like a fair bit of like kind of Pokemon vibes. And I think that mostly comes from, so Michael's touchstone for Daibokin is obviously Digimon.
Yeah.
And my touchstone for Daibokin is very Pokemon.
Yeah.
And just picturing sort of the like colorful outfits that are like very, very anime and very out there.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I kind of keep coming back to for Kindred specifically.
Makes sense. How does it feel to be the GM of the show after being a player in season one? And what's your favorite thing about each of those roles?
Ooh. GM is more work.
Yep.
You get it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's totally different lenses. In season one as a player, I really only had to think about Angus and what his arc looked like and what how he would respond in any given situation. Occasionally, you know, there might be collaboration with other players in regards to like the relationships and stuff that developed, but that was pretty much the only thing I had to focus on. And then as a GM, you have to focus on everything.
Yeah.
Not just the world and the conflicts and the NPCs, but you also have to think about the characters. And maybe that comes as a result of not being set in like small town Null, where all of us kind of have the same touchstones and we all kind of know how to do the heavy lifting with that. With Operablum, I feel a little bit sometimes like, actually, I don't know how true this is as I say it, but like, there's almost the feeling that like the world is, there are rules to the world that not everyone knows, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Which isn't true, because I'm pretty improv-y as a GM, so my rules are, if you say it on mic, it's true.
But I think it's giving that impression of, no, there is a larger world, and there are elements of it that we don't necessarily understand as an audience or even as the players in the game.
Yeah.
But there is this, like, there's internal logic to everything, even if we haven't been introduced to it necessarily. And sometimes that can make for really fun improv moments where we're just like, oh, of course it's this. We all know, even though it doesn't make any sense at all. But we're like, in this world, it does. We decided.
Exactly, right? Anytime someone throws out like, oh, and this is the game that we would play in this scenario. It's like, yeah, of course, obviously. Yes, this is the food that you would eat. 100%.
I think it was in a recent episode that I said something about like, I had to pay for something and was like, I guess we boop our two tablets together or like, what is money in this world? We've never covered it.
See, that's the thing. Every other GM would be like, I know exactly how money works in this world. And I'm pretty sure I've had conversations with Dave and Liam about like, well, how does money work? And it's like, oh, it could work like this or like that. But that was all off mic. So it's all speculative. So it's not until you say we boop our tablets together.
Yeah.
I had nothing before that.
Well, now it's canon.
Now it's canon. Leaning on those improv chops, baby.
So what were some ways that you tried to make season two different from season one, stand apart? What were some things that you wanted to like, areas where you wanted to explore new territory or push boundaries? And what were some areas that you wanted to carry over from season one and keep consistent from season to season?
I think the first thing that I wanted to play with was how the crew came together. In season one, it was very clean slate. No one really knew each other. We all kind of met for the first time at the party in the gravel pits that then went into Vestige. And from there, we may have heard of each other or like seen each other in class or stuff like that. But it was very clean slate for all of our players. We were starting from the very beginning.
That was very intentional, too. Yes. I really wanted to. I've played a lot of campaigns where you come in with pre-existing parties. Even if it's, you know, you've never played together before, you say like, oh, yeah, but we have this long history and we go way back. And I really wanted this one. Felt like any coming of age story. From the Breakfast Club to Animorphs, like you want to see how the group comes together and how they form that bond.
Absolutely. So I do think it was absolutely the right call for season one, right? The very start of this podcast, start of like an actual play for Slug Blaster, right? Getting people on board with the tropes that we were exploring.
Yeah.
100%. And I feel like it's something that you can really easily default to doing again with a new group of people.
Mm-hmm.
But I liked the idea of us trying new ways to already know each other or to have met each other and seeing how that sort of influences the dynamic. So I really like that Maeve, Brinley, and Helix were already a part of a crew, that Walton already had this very strong connection to the Wicks. I love how quickly another faction was introduced. That was very fun. And then Trev War was kind of the one random element that was thrown in that ended up being sort of like the thing that draws everyone together. Yeah, so I think that was a really fun sort of jumping off point for us. I liked starting in the middle of a run. Pretty low stakes run, all things considered. You're basically doing a small competition with another crew, but it was just a nice way to get everyone in on the action right away. That very first run, too, is quite different, I think, from anything we've done, because with both starting in the middle of a run and then returning home, not to Null, but to Operablum, that first episode had to do a lot of heavy lifting to sort of establish who everyone was, what their deal was, and where we were, and why that mattered. So there was definitely a lot going on, even just from the very, very beginning.
And I think it was a really clever way to prime people for what we were trying to do with this season. Again, season one, very intentional, like introducing each character one by one, slowly bringing them together, but also introducing the world and the familiar elements, and then slowly peppering in the like divergences. These are the sci-fi elements, and like kind of taking the audience by the hand and being like, okay, I know you don't know what slug blasting is and hoverboarding and how any of that works. We're going to introduce it a little at a time. And I think that worked for that setting and was a good way to bring people on board the show. If we tried to do that in season two, if we tried to start in the day-to-day of Operablum and then like slowly explore each character's deal and bring them together, I feel like it would take so many episodes and be so alienating so quickly. And the thing we needed to communicate to the audience right away was like, it's fine that you don't understand any of this. Like, you're not supposed to know what each tower's deal is and how all the science works and what slug blasting is and what each, you know, what a Thenis Spartian is. All of that will be explained in time and you'll know when you need to know. But we needed to very quickly set the expectation that you don't need any prior knowledge for this.
Yes.
And so throwing people into the middle of the action, in the middle of a run with characters who already have relationships, I think communicated really clearly, like, just go with it. We're on the ride. We're already in the middle of it. You don't need to. We're not starting at the beginning, so don't feel like you had to do homework for this.
Yeah, totally. And then, of course, in the very next run, that was the run where we got to, like, dig into what being in Operablum was about.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I think, yeah, as far as keeping what I wanted to keep the same, I think that was something that I didn't have to stress about as much because we were still basically playing Slug Blaster, right? Like the sneaking into other dimensions and doing cool stuff was always going to be a consistent thing. That being said, it was important to me to frequently come back to the kinds of runs that I called classic Slug Blaster runs.
Yeah.
Because we had a run that was all about like, oh, we're in Operablum and figuring out what Operablum is all about. Oh, and then we're going to DiboCon. And like, there were so many opportunities for us to get into like really nitty gritty situations where, again, it feels like there's a lot of rules to it. And it's not very like hoverboard around and shoot monsters with ray guns, but a lot more like maybe politically charged or socially charged. So one thing that I really, really cared about that I really wanted to make sure was still consistent throughout season two was that we did have those runs where we hoverboard in another dimension and encounter weirdness and shoot monsters, like the run in Empyrean, like the Wilkie's run to a degree, or Vestige or Desneen.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So during the process of planning season two, were there any ideas that you had during that planning that just never found their way into the finished product of the show? Were there any ideas that were on the table that intrigued you in the planning stages that just for one reason or another, we never got around to visiting that plot point or exploring that monster or what have you?
I don't think so.
That's impressive.
Yeah.
It all made it in.
I think, because there were definitely, I had a lot of irons in the fire, for sure, and a lot of goals that I wanted to achieve. Like, obviously, establishing Operablum as a really strong world and home base was a big goal that I was able to sort of knock out of the way is what I wanted to say. That I was able to sort of check that box mm-hmm. pretty early. I think from there, I went pretty quickly into the somewhat more character-focused runs, starting with Wolt in Popularia and DaiboCon. And then, you know, there was the delivery run for Brinley and the Fust run for Helix and those kinds of things. So I think the character-focused runs are really nice to just, like, help me remember who the story is about and also give more structure to the overall arc. From there, it was easy for me to sort of, like, figure out which dimensions I wanted to explore. I guess the idea of a null run was always something that was, like, floating around.
Yeah.
And that one was kind of a tricky one for me because the idea of null is it is supposed to be the home base. So as a result, it's not supposed to be all that exciting.
Yeah.
And it's not that I think that you can't do a run in null. I think there's a lot of interesting ways that you could explore null as someone from another dimension. But the specifics of what that was never really crystallized for me in a way that I felt like it could be a full run. Obviously, mm-hmm. we did go to Null as part of Helix's Fust run.
Yeah.
And I knew it was somewhere that I wanted to visit. And I think it was a dimension that Liam and Dave in particular were quite excited to visit as characters from another dimension. But yeah, it never quite came together in a way that felt like it would be a good full run. So my compromise was to visit it for part of a run.
Yeah, and that's interesting because I always forget that it's not a fully null run, that we did spend time in the Golden Jungle and stuff during that and Thenispar, because Fust is from null and the TV show is from null. So in my brain, that is the null run, even though it's like, well, I guess actually we don't spend a ton of time in null. We kind of just do the church basement thing.
Yeah, that was it.
Church roof thing. That's really funny.
Yeah.
All right, I have some more rapid-fire kind of questions, just some, you know, stand-up moments and favorites and stuff. Mm-hmm. Starting with, what was your favorite monster that you threw at us in Season 2?
Y'all had better be caught up if you're listening to this episode, because it's the Peeler-Eyed Dreadfly, baby!
Yeah.
I read that monster in the rulebook and fell in love so instantly. I was like, this, Mikey, you genius. It's so good. And I was so excited to break that monster out at some point. I knew it was going to be a late season enemy.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to make sure that all of the characters were established enough that when these alternates were created, we all knew what to expect, which was so amazing. Mm-hmm. Like, so many times in recording that, the player would say, oh, and then there's this type of alternate that does this and this type of alternate that does that. And I'll often joke like, Michael, stop reading my notes. But literally it was like, y'all are reading my notes.
Yeah.
And I love it. Yeah. Oh, God. I love the Peeler-Eyed Dreadfly so much.
I think, yeah, it speaks to the strength of the character definition that we all, as soon as the prompt of alternate version of your character came up, we all knew exactly what that would look like for each character and could, like, pitch them for each other and ourselves in the same way that you would have written in your notes. Wild stuff.
Absolutely. It's so cool that we all know how far the characters have come and where they could have gone and to fully explore that. I called that the Quahalia run. It wasn't in Quahalia, but it felt like it had sort of the same impact that the Quahalia run in Season 1 had.
Yeah, that same, like, let's do a quick character deep dive before we get into the end game to really remember who these people are and what they want and where they need to go, and then we'll throw them into the fire.
Yeah.
What was your favorite dimension to play in, and or were there any that you wanted to see more of?
I had a really good time exploring the dimensions further. I think all of these dimensions are really cool and really evocative, and there's multiple different ways that you can sort of visit the same dimension. And that was something that I really wanted to keep in mind as we looked at each dimension. Is like, I think I have a table in my many, many, many notes of like, what are the key features of this dimension? What have we already seen? What could be cool to see? So like Desneen, for example, in season one, we saw an underwater base, basically an underwater research station. And this time around, we saw a floating coral reef with the coral moon and stuff like that. So that kind of thing. I think my favorite dimension to explore was the Wilkie's pocket dimension.
Absolutely.
I had so much fun with that. And I think everyone else did, too. I think as far as like dimensions to explore more of, for me, I think it would be a toss-up between Calorium or the Golden Jungle. Calorium, I think we did touch on a couple of times. And I think same with the Golden Jungle. But I think both of them have elements of potential civilization that I feel like could be really cool to explore. What would a city in Calorium look like? What if you actually find an abandoned temple in the Golden Jungle? I feel like there's a lot of potential there that I would have really liked to explore, but I think with the characters and their trajectories, it didn't necessarily mesh. It didn't necessarily make sense.
Yeah, totally. What were the biggest surprises that players threw at you in season two?
Oh, boy. There were definitely moments where the players would pitch something or go somewhere that I was like, oh, these notes are now irrelevant. And I think it honestly started in session zero. I have a GM featurette on this, actually, on the Prismatia run on Patreon. But my plan for session one, I think, was going to be a run in Calorium.
Yes.
And I had a couple different ideas about, like, who could be on a team and who wouldn't be on a team and that kind of thing. And the players were the ones who had all pitched that, like, who would it make sense to be on a team? Maeve, Brynlee, Helix was what we eventually landed on. And then together, all the players brainstormed, oh, what if the Wicks are trying to recruit Wolt? They challenge Tetrachromacy, but it has to be 4 versus 4, so now they rent Trev. And I'm like, oh, you've already got your crew makeup figured out, your, you know, pre-crew makeup. That changes things. That changes things for what this session one should look like. So right away, immediately, I learned the lesson that, like, GM planning is a team effort.
Yeah.
You have to take into account where people want to go and what they want to do. So that was probably like the most impactful surprise. But there were lots. I think another big one that stands out to me is Glenna's last episode.
Right.
And the way that, you know, Brynlee confronted the Nexus Master. The other thing I've learned, actually, is y'all don't do chases.
Nah, if you want us to run, you basically have to tell us that that's what we're doing, because we will always try to fight
track
it.
On episode one was chase, and even then y'all didn't take the hint. I don't know how much clearer I can be. One of the Wicks yelled, "Let's get out of here," and y'all were like, no. So anytime that I'm creating a scenario where I feel like it's going to be a chase, where you need to escape, where you need to get out of there, I need a contingency, because all of you are more likely to confront the thing. It happened with the Glasshoppers in episode one, and it happened with Brynlee and the Nexus Master.
Yep.
And it kind of happened again when Brynlee smashed the tablet, although that time she actually did run away.
Yeah.
But that, again, I had a whole outro written based on Shimmer getting the tablet back, and they didn't. She wrecked it and wrecked a lot of their plans in the process. So I actually had to rewrite and re-record that outro and read it for all of you and be like, this is actually what happened because Glenna's a genius.
Yeah, for a very amicable exit from the show, it is funny how much it was like a table flip. Like, I'm done, so I'm here. There goes the board.
I love it. I love it so much. Every time Glenna was like, I have an idea and it's stupid, I'm like, this is going to be the best part of the episode. Let's go.
100%. And then my final rapid fire question here, just any other standout moments from the campaign so far that you want to shout out? Any fond memories of season two?
Oh, man.
I know that's very open-ended, and I'm putting you on the spot, but...
We've had so many episodes, and there were so many good moments. Oh, boy.
You want to do, like, one for each character?
Yeah, I do. I think for Walt, again, speaking of players surprising me and doing things I don't expect, the fust run started to turn into Walt questioning his involvement with Gold Star Disaster and his ability to be involved with Gold Star Disaster. And the Wix, for me, had always been a chance to push those buttons. Mm-hmm. And again, my expectation was that the Wix would push so that Walt could push back.
Yeah.
And I was not expecting in the confrontation in the Waking Pits, or even in the Golden Jungle when they first found him, I wasn't expecting him to go with them. And it created such a cool exploration with Gold Star Disaster and Walt's relationship to them and Walt's relationship to the Wix that I think was so much deeper and more profound than if they had just pushed and he had pushed back and been like, my resolve is stronger than ever.
Yeah.
He went into that place of uncertainty and weakness that developed and strengthened his character so much more.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think for Helix and for Maeve, running off in Wilkie's. I love that moment. Y'all made problems for yourselves by trying the mushrooms. And I think it was there that I was like, I spent a bite when you did it. And I'm like, I'm not going to do this anymore. Like, if you guys give yourselves problems, you're in it now. You're giving that to me for free. Why am I spending my resources when you put it on a silver platter?
I think as soon as we arrived in the candy dimension, it became clear that like, oh, some of us have a job to do and are going to be very goal-oriented and mission-focused in this run, but we're in Candy World, and if we all go on the goal-oriented path, we're not going to get to see much of Candy World because we're going to be focused on getting the job done and delivering the package. And I think Liam and I made very conscious decisions to like, well, we're the ones that it maybe makes the most sense to not be super invested in this. So we need to go and get into trouble and just be teenagers because we want to see more of this rich world that Lena has crafted for us. And we're not going to get to if we just go straight to the factory.
And I love that. I love that so much.
Let's take our time on the way to the fireworks factory run.
Well, you were in the fireworks factory, basically. And it's like, well, now that we're in the fireworks factory, we need to pull this lever. Yeah. And y'all were like, no, we're setting off some fireworks.
Yeah.
I only wish y'all had rolled more mixed successes so I could throw more candy logic injuries at you.
Absolutely.
But that's okay. okay, Trev 4 would be Daibokan.
Yeah. the most high stakes Trev subplot in the entire season.
High stakes. And later the montage of him at the Daibokan fashion show.
Yeah.
That again, everyone else is like, we're doing stuff, and Trev 4 is like, no, this is what matters. Yeah. I'm gonna run off and do this nonsense. and I feel like that's a thing that Dave and I sometimes fall into as well, where he's like, here is the bonkers thing that I'm going to talk to you about. And then I'm just like, yes, you know what? Mm-hmm, that is correct. I think in the Treadfly thing, it was about burgers.
Yep.
Although that's more just Dave being like, what about this analogy that's weird? And I'm like, no, you know what? You're absolutely correct. Those are maybe my favorite interactions with Dave.
I think that went into the promo clip. It was so good.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And with Brinley, like, I think that final run is a big one for me.
Yeah.
But I think I also need to shout out her confrontation with Mr. Wilkie, because she was the only one who met the actual weird blob demon, and had a confrontation with him and how that all played out, and especially evoking parkour.
For mental gymnastics.
For mental gymnastics. Yeah. Best... a quote-unquote monster confrontation and resolution of the season. I'm calling it now.
I think it's hilarious that we have a sponsorship with Wilkie's and none of us ever met real Wilkie.
Y'all think like, he's a Guy Fieri looking dude.
Very good. All right. And to end things off, my final question for you today, what are your goals for this final run of episodes and slash what are you excited to see in this final run of episodes?
Oh, I have been sitting on this final conflict for a long, long time. And the fact that I was finally able to reveal it was such a cool moment. I think when I first came up with it, I wrote it down and I was like, is this dumb? And I think my response to myself was, yes, it's Slug Blaster.
Yep.
So I'm very excited that we are sort of at this crux point where everything kind of hangs in the balance and it's high stakes in its own unique way. It's again, unique from season one and maybe unique to what anyone might do in Slug Blaster. I am very excited to see how you all sort of address this within the broader world of Operablum. I think there are, trying not to get too spoilery here, but I think there are going to be some future confrontations with Shimmer and with the Arborists. All of those question marks, I think, are finally going to come to a head. And I think it's going to challenge the characters in some interesting ways. And I kind of, as much as I have ideas about where things are going to go, as much as I have cut scenes written and encounters planned and progress tracks drafted, I also know that y'all are going to throw me for a loop because you're so good at that. And I am excited to see how I have to scrap my notes and come up with something else.
Fantastic. Well, if you listeners are also excited to see how we fuck up all of Lena's plans, you can find out in 2 weeks' time when we release the first chapter of what is sure to be a sprawling multi-part epic of our final run. And if you can't wait 2 whole weeks to start that adventure, because that is admittedly a long time, again, subscribe to our Patreon. You get new content every single Monday, whether that is an advanced copy of the latest episode or outtakes like it's going to be this coming Monday or interviews like this one or, you know, playthroughs of different game systems or little one-off videos where we eat weird sandwiches. We've done it all, folks, and you can find it all on the Patreon, patreon.com/quantumkickflip. Definitely give it a look. Thank you so much for joining us here today, listeners, and thank you, Lena, for sitting down and chatting with me.
Yeah, thank you so much for this interview. It was a great old time.
And now I will go back to player mode.
It's me, your Slugmaster Game Blaster.